Hello and welcome to the Aesthetic Insider Show. I'm Angela O'Mara and I'm here today with Dr. Nima Shemarani. Dr. Shemarani is a rhinoplasty expert who practices in Beverly Hills, California. His road to success has been a really interesting journey. And today we're going to talk about, is it an overnight success or is it resilience? Dr. Shemarani, welcome to the Aesthetic Insider Show. It's such a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you for having me, Angela. I'm excited to be part of the show today.
Absolutely. You know, well, let's just start with where you're from. Tell our audience, you know, just more about yourself.
Sure. My name is Nima Shemarani. I grew up in San Diego, California, where I ended up going to college. And then when the time came to go to medical school, I went to the Medical College of Wisconsin. I was a little worried about leaving my home, but I went to Milwaukee and it was a great experience. I went to medical school there. I did my residency training in ENT, basically head and neck surgery, otolaryngology. And from there, I went to New Jersey where I spent an additional year doing facial plastic surgery at the Glass Gold Group. From there, it was about 2010, and I knew I always wanted to come back to Southern California to be closer to my family. But San Diego just wasn't as competitive as an environment as I wanted to be in. And I already had some family also in Los Angeles, so I decided to come to Beverly Hills to open up my practice.
You know, that's interesting because you use the word competitive. And I was listening to a podcast last night, and one of the questions that the interviewer was asking was about, was this particular person ambitious? And she said, I was never ambitious. However, you would think if you knew the life of this person that, wow, she was a really ambitious woman. Do you think competition and ambition are the same thing? How do you view competition?
Yeah, I think they are birds of a feather. They're kind of along the same lines. So many people are so worried about competition, but I think competition just makes you a better surgeon. If you are naturally a competitive person that forces you to do better, to perform better, then I think being in a highly competitive place will make you a better, you know, surgeon or whatever field you're going into. So I'm a big believer that competition can actually be beneficial for you because it kind of lights a fire under your butt. You look around and you're just like, wow, if this person is producing these amazing results, I need to produce those amazing results. And I think in the end, it just makes you a better surgeon. If you're surrounded by mediocrity, you will be a mediocre surgeon. A lot of people think that, well, I'll just be better than the best mediocre surgeon. And that's just not good enough. I think you should be around people who just really crush it so that you can come in and have something to strive for and eventually beat.
Yeah, I think that I absolutely agree with that. Well, Nima, you know, you and I met many, many years ago. And that was kind of when you were first, you know, embarking on this journey that you've had in Beverly Hills, which is a highly competitive environment, especially in plastic surgery, but medicine in general. So kind of I'd love for you to, you know, share some of the trials and tribulations along the way as from when you said, okay, it's not San Diego, it's Beverly Hills. Then what did you do?
Yeah, as a quick kind of message to start things off, you know, for people who are listening, you don't fail until you quit. So you know, if you don't quit, then you won't fail. And there will be setbacks, but that's part of the journey. And it's how you react to those setbacks, which will make you eventually successful. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're going to be starting out a practice, I think my recommendation, I mean, that's what I did, was I just sublet an office space for a year because I was new to the area. I didn't really know anybody. And I don't want to sign a long 5 or 10 year contract in case something didn't go right. So the first person I met was, honestly, it was this plastic surgeon that was quite a bit older than me. He was kind of on the other end of his career. And just like in LA, I was promised, oh, I'll introduce you to everybody. I'll teach you how I do my surgery so that you can be better. And I showed up and it wasn't that much of a commitment, you know, but his practice was dead. I mean, I didn't see any patients coming in at all. I don't know how he made money, to be frank. And he, you know, introduced me to people or anything like that. But I put myself out there. The one piece of advice they gave me was go to Chamber of Commerce events and meet like other business people. And another thing of life is you just need to show up because you don't know where it's going to take you. You know, nothing good ever happens at home. It always happens when you're out. And the the next journey took me to, basically, I met this accountant who knew this famous dermatologist named Simon Orion, and I got hooked up with him, and I switched offices, and I sublet out of his office. And from there, my opportunities continued to grow. And don't be discouraged. Like, I think when people first moved to Beverly Hills, they expected a Rodeo Drive style practice without any money. I mean, I found like an eyelash extension spa in West Hollywood, not even a nice part of West Hollywood. It was like East West Hollywood. And I can't believe people let me inject fillers and Botox in that, you know, in that area. I was quoting prices myself. I was taking my own photos. The lighting was off. I mean, you really do struggle at the beginning. But to be frank, like, it's crazy. A couple of those patients still follow me to this day, and it's been, you know, almost 13 years.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, I know that you have mentioned that kind of when you first got going, your money that you had really had come from what you had saved during your getting your medical degree. And yes. You said you had about $10,000 saved.
Yeah.
I'm sure you watched that money grow.
Yeah, I would encourage people who, you know, obviously saving is a good habit to employ, because if you have savings, then you can invest them into your business. And I really didn't have that much. In my fellowship, I had this opportunity to start suturing kids in the ER, and then I would bill insurance. So I learned insurance billing while I was a fellow. Mm-hmm. And I still remember seeing my first check for $1,600 for suturing like a 5-year-old up. And I'm like, wow, I can't believe I'm getting paid for this. Before, I used to do this stuff for free. And it really was the first like little taste of what was to come. And, you know, I brought that savings. It was enough to start like a few months of rent, but I immediately started some locum tenens. So I was single at the time, and I would fly to Phoenix for 7 to 10 days a month, work in a hospital. It was a fantastic gig, actually. The nurses were super nice. And I would take that money and bring it back to LA and invest it in like marketing. And even while I was there, I was working. I was working on my website. I was working on my copy. I was doing all kinds of stuff there. So that's essentially how I started my practice, bootstrapping it myself. You know, I didn't take out a loan, but I would make like, I don't know, $10,000 to $15,000 a month, and then bring it back to LA.
Yeah. You know, and when you say like reinvesting back into your business, you're reinvesting back into yourself and back into your future. And I think many doctors and nurses and just business owners in general, is they don't really think about kind of that they're all entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. You know, and as an entrepreneur, you have to look at your medical practice from a different perspective and see it as, you know, the investment that you're making in your future and your future practice growth. So that $10,000 went a long way. I don't know if, you know, could we start in Beverly Hills today with $10,000? Probably the answer is yes, right? You can start from wherever you're at.
Absolutely. I think you can start with a minimal amount of money. I mean, you could sublet an office for $1,000 a month for a room if you really looked hard enough. But it's just to get your feet wet, and you just need to start somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. So I really think one of the attributes that you have, and I think I knew this when I met you, and I specifically saw it when I watched an Instagram post of you at the gym. We've laughed about the Turkish roll or the Turkish, what is it called, that particular move that you were doing in that video?
It's a Turkish getup. It's like a total full body. Like every single muscle is worked out in this one exercise.
Yeah. And at the time I saw you do that, I had actually been in a boot camp class, and the instructor was trying to get me to do that particular move with a kettlebell, not as big a kettlebell as you were holding, but with a kettlebell. And I really struggled. I finally got up and got back down again. And then I saw you do it, and it's like, oh my God, it looks so easy. He makes it look effortless. And having said that, I think an overnight success, most people think it just happened overnight, right? There was no effort in this. But again, that Turkish roll and what it takes to perfect that move takes resilience.
Absolutely.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, sometimes when I struggle in my surgeries that can take a little bit longer, that are challenging, or struggling in business, I think of people like Kobe Bryant had mentioned, you know, no matter what, no one will outwork me. Like, no one will put in the kind of work that I'll put in to push through. And sometimes, or a lot of times, that's what it takes. The fun lifestyle videos that people see after people have become successful, again, they think it looks so easy, but the grind is what makes it, what builds your character. I don't think it's, if it was easy, then you would kind of be like a spoiled brat about it and just not be a nice person. But that struggle of going through it is awesome, because you can like look back at your life and say, wow, look at what I've lived through, look at the challenges I've faced. It builds self-confidence, self-esteem, and I wouldn't trade it. And I think most entrepreneurs would not, when you're talking about like Jeff Bezos in his office and the Amazon spray painted sign in the back, like everybody looks back at that and say like, wow, look where I came from, look where I am now. And I think that growth of your own life is what's truly fulfilling.
One of the things that I have talked about with other people is like business plans and strategy, and just mentioning like Jeff Bezos as a for instance. And I'm sure when he was sitting there with his spray painted Amazon behind him, he could never have strategized or written in a plan what occurred. I mean, you just can't make that up in a business plan. Like, I mean, you can go through so many stages of, year one, we're going to do this, year two, we're going to do that. But I think a lot of it just has to come with, like you said, if you're at home and you're not out there mixing and moving with people, you just can't plan a life in a business plan. I'm sure you've had a business plan, when you, like, so you met with accountants and you met with other types of managers to surround yourself with experts that can guide you. But do you think some of it is really just based on drive?
Yeah. So the speaking about the business plan, I did a Word document, like templated business plan, and they were long. I mean, it's like 25 pages. There's some like great questions in there, like how do you expect to market? How are you going to differentiate yourself? Like questions you should be asking yourself. But I always found the projections to be really funny. It's like, you're making literally $0 or negative dollars. What are you going to make in 1 year, in 5 years? Like those numbers were so made up and arbitrary that I think they're kind of useless. So the value in the business plan comes in the questions you need to ask yourself and to approach. How are you going to allocate your resources, and how much you're going to dedicate to marketing, savings, your own life that you got to live as well. So that's where I think the business plan comes in handy. But you're right, you cannot plan everything. And just like how I chose facial plastic surgery, I didn't just one day wake up, in college and think I wanted to be a rhinoplasty surgeon. I just went through the motions of like, I'm gonna go to medical school. These are the kind of patients I want to treat. I want to be a surgeon. I don't want to have a surgeon's hours. I want to have my own business. I don't want to rely on insurance companies. And that kind of back and forth, you're honing down what you want to do. So I never had a full-on plan a long time ago, but you just start the process, and the plan will present itself as time goes on.
Well, and that's great that you say that, because I think for many people, especially younger people, whether they're doctors or students or whatever they may be, is you think there's kind of a defined path that you want to be a doctor, this is the defined path. You want to be an attorney, this is a defined path. These careers that have been traditional careers. And now, of course, we have so many careers that we could have not even imagined 10 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. But what you're saying, though, is for you knew there was a path of in medicine that you wanted, but you really went through what you like and what you don't like, what you want and what you don't want, and narrowed it down to really personal preferences. And seems like you've made it in those in down that path. They worked for you.
Yeah, I would think that it should work for most people. It is so hard to pinpoint exactly what you want to do, and think if you're able to follow your own signs and your own, oh, I feel good doing this, I don't feel good doing that. Do you like to work with people? Do you not like to work with people? I mean, those are big things as well. And then learning things that they don't teach you in school. I'm a big believer in personal development, reading books like how to interact with people, how to treat people, how to think for yourself, and applying those principles. Because if you don't have that, then it's going to be really difficult to learn that stuff on your own. There's no point to. Yeah, we have such as the history of the world is accessible, on your computer or in a library, and on Amazon in form of books that you don't need to relearn how to make the wheel. You can learn how to interact with people pretty easily. And from there, you decide what you want to do, basically.
Yeah, and I do think there is that, you know, everything that you need is available at your fingertips if you believe in it and if you look hard enough. You know what I mean? And maybe sometimes you don't even need to look that hard. It's right there in front of you. So having something like your personal development, which can go to many, many levels of and ideas, but talking about books, is there a particular book that really stands out to you? I mean, because I can remember certain books that it's changed over the years with what book kind of resonated with me at that moment. But today, is there any particular book that really resonates with you that would be a good read?
Absolutely. There are two books I recommend. One is How to Deal with People, and the second is How to Deal with Yourself, that kind of serve as the foundation for most, you know, How to Deal with People for most sales books, management books, leadership books. It's all applicable relationship books, is How to Win Friends and Influence People. I mean, I read that book for the first time when I was 30, and it changed my life. I'm like, wow. Like, it's not about how to manipulate people, but it's just how to be a little bit more thoughtful with people, like remembering their names, smiling when you talk to them. You know, when you write like an email, not saying I this, I that, I this, like, how can I help you? And so when you read a book like How to Win Friends and Influence People, and then you start to practice it, which is important, you know, try it out, you get a lot of positive reinforcement to continue that personal development journey. And Think and Grow Rich is very similar, but it's more on managing yourself in your own mind about how to avoid negative self-talk, how to associate with other successful people, how to handle your own fears and doubts. And both of those books are very old. You know, I think How to Win Friends and Influence People is almost 100 years old. Think and Grow Rich, I think, was written in the 40s. But wow, they are powerful. Two powerful books I think will change your life.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because they're both books that I definitely would highly recommend too. And yeah, and I actually only read that Think and Grow Rich in recent years, you know, and it's fascinating to think that all of these examples of the world's most successful people and kind of how they got where they did. And there's a running theme throughout these books as to what it takes. And again, it's right there under your nose. You just have to sometimes be reminded of it.
Yeah. What did you think of those two books?
I love them. I love them. And I agree with you. And I think, you know, many of us do, forget. And whether it's because as you begin to grow in your business or your practice, you just get busy. And as you get busy, you're dealing with a lot of things. So maybe your way you treat people isn't intentional. It's more based on you're always on the run. You're always trying to get there. You've got so many irons in the fire that you forget to be nice.
Yeah.
Or we have so many emails that we, you know, go to where we used to say, "Hi, Nima, how are you? I have a quick question," to, "I have a question."
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you take the niceness out of it, and it's not intentional. It's just, I'm busy and busy doing this. And so I think for me, you know, like those books that you mentioned, is it just makes you sit back and think, how am I communicating?
Mm-hmm.
And when I communicate this way, what response do I get back from a staff member, from a friend, from a person? And it's usually not the response that you want.
Yeah.
Was there mirroring you? And so that was kind of a good lesson for me, was in there's a lot of mirroring that takes place in life. And if you want to be treated a certain way, you need to treat others.
Yeah.
Way. And that's so, and I think that's how you build a team as well, is, you know, I think in especially Think and Grow Rich, I mean, some of those people that are mentioned in the book weren't necessarily the nicest team leaders, but they did earn and gain respect because of their vision. And somehow they brought on people who could be on that journey to that vision. Like Henry Ford, for instance, you know, I mean, we wouldn't be driving the way we do today if it were not for that man. But was he the best team leader? Probably not. I mean, in terms of how, whether he was nice or not nice to people, you know, I mean, I think he just was so driven by his vision.
Yeah.
People went along with him. So I think I love those books, and I think I learned a lot from them. How do you feel about your in you know your team that you have developed? Was that influenced by anything you read in books like that?
I have all of my staff read How to Win Friends and Influence People as a way to, as a customer service kind of book, as well as how to interact with each other. A slight side note is, you hear doctors complaining how they can never find great staff members and about the mirroring. And, tongue in cheek, sometimes you look at those doctors, it's like, well,
What
that reflection
about
on
you?
you. Yeah. It's like those people who say, like, I can never find like a good boyfriend or a good girlfriend. It's like, well, if it's everybody else, then maybe it's you. Like it can't be like everybody is horrible. And, in our growth in our practice, we're now starting to implement this something called the EOS, which is the Entrepreneurial Operating System. Essentially, it's a way of having more meetings and then setting goals and then holding each other responsible. But the more frequent meetings can sometimes seem annoying, but actually, it's been a really effective communication tool where we stay abreast on like what everybody else is doing, so that we avoid conflicts down the road, and be hashed out gets hashed out, even if it's uncomfortable. So I think that that communication and keeping it open, and you have to have humility. I mean, I think having ideal team members, they said, are supposed to be hungry, humble, and smart. You have to be humble enough to take criticism and smart enough to deal with people so that you can incorporate well as a team, and hungry because no one wants to stay the same. Like there's changes inevitable. So, but that's how we deal with our staff. I have them read the book, and then we have frequent meetings so that communication is open, and stuff doesn't just build up. I mean, I'm sure you've had that issue too with staff members that just kind of piss you off, piss you off, piss you off, and all of a sudden, like the relationship is irreparable, basically.
Well, I think as well is and it's learning, because again, when you first start out, you're excited and it's everything's new, and and maybe you have a relationship with a staff member, meet, and I don't mean a relationship, but a relationship with them where you let things slide, because you like them and you don't want to lose them or different things. But then I think as you grow personally, and perhaps that person doesn't grow with the team the way you expected them to. And you do, you just, okay, well, they've been with me a long time. I'll just keep them on. And it's not a good idea, but I think you learn that again as you grow within your business.
I think that is probably the toughest challenge to deal with when you're growing as a practice, because I was just speaking with someone who wants to start his own practice. That first person you hire, is usually a pretty like $20, $25 an hour employee. But they wear so many hats that as your practice grows, that person's position ends up being like a six-figure salary. And if they haven't grown into that skill set, then it's a very uncomfortable talk you have to have. Well, I've been with you since the beginning. How could you do this to me? But it's like, well, if you can't grow and handle the workload, then we can't work together. So that I think is probably the biggest challenge, I would say. I don't know what you would say when you're growing a business. But that's hard because you're dealing with people's emotions and their livelihood. You feel bad because it's a job.
It's interesting. Many years ago, I had a client that we were consulting with, and he was a facial plastic surgeon in Newport Beach. And he had had a receptionist, and she'd been with him for many years, and she was great. She was a great receptionist. And during the consultation, but she was, she and again, she'd been with him a long time, but she was kind of becoming like an angry receptionist. So when we were doing this consultation, it was kind of like, well, I know she's been with you a long time, but she's not the nicest receptionist when you walk in. I mean, she's quite bossy with the patients, and she doesn't greet them. And in cosmetic surgery, I mean, patients are cash. This is, they're not coming to you because they need to. They're coming to you because they want to, and they're spending cash with you. So in part of the whole consultation, she was one of the people we sat down with. We talked about her job and what she liked, what she didn't like, and how could it be improved, and what were her thoughts on the practice. And she said, I feel that my job as a receptionist is really important, and that I would like to be called the director of patient relations, because that I direct the patients. I'm not just the person who answers the phone. I'm not just a receptionist. I want to be called the director of patient relations. Okay, what do you think about your salary? She goes, well, I don't think I'm paid adequately for the role of being the director of patient relations. So then when we go back to the client and say, okay, this is the opinion of the person who, basically, she answers your phone. So all of your marketing, all of your outreach, all of your networking, all channels to that phone, or that nowadays is that email. And if you're a person who's at the end of that funnel and she's not answering the phone and being invited and engaging and bringing that person in, then all that money you've spent on everything else was a waste of time. And so he says, so what do we do? And I said, I think you need to give her a promotion and a title, and you need to give her a little bit more money. And he said, okay. You know, she can call herself the president of the United States as long as she still does the job of a receptionist. And it was kind of, for me, that was an interesting thing, because it really made me understand the importance of a title and a business card and what somebody can say when, you know, oh, well, what do you do? Oh, I'm a receptionist, versus I'm the director of patient relations at this medical practice. It changed her. And it was like overnight, she became exactly the employee we all wanted her to be.
Interesting.
You know, and it was just, and again, it kind of was just a mental shift on everybody's part as to, well, we still want her to do the job that she's doing, because she was good when she was good. And then she'd be bad when she was bad, you know. So, do you find anything in your practice in terms of, you know, how do you make your staff feel important in their particular role?
I think certain things, and I learned this from How to Win Friends and Influence People, but acknowledging when they do a good job, you know, especially patients will tell me like, oh, you know, you're like Rajneet, I love her. She's so smiley. Like Jasmine's such a great PA. Tracy's the best patient care coordinator I've ever spoken to. You know, we have OR staff, like Sharon was an amazing nurse. And going back and telling them, like, I think that really lights them up when they get to hear that positive feedback, and just not ignoring it. And you know, you have to pass along the message. Asking them, you know, without getting too personal, because some people don't want to share personal stuff, so it's a fine line. You know, how was your weekend? How's it going? You have any plans for the weekends? To show interest, would be interested. I don't think it should be fake if you genuinely care about that person. So it's things that you just have to be mindful of. And that book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, will remind you. It sounds like common sense to ask people how they're doing and to pass along compliments, but we forget that all the time. And I think you just have to be a little bit more present, a little bit more aware, not super focused on just what you have to accomplish, because your team will help you accomplish it for you. And I think those little investments of that time will pay off much bigger dividends than if you're trying to just pull the whole thing yourself, basically.
Yeah. You know, another little book that was helpful to me over the years was called Who Stole My Cheese?
Oh, yes, I've heard of it.
You know, and that was really, it's a tale of two mice. And basically, one mouse, you know, they wake up one day, the cheese is gone. It's gone. They've been these fat mice living on this piece of cheese, and the cheese is gone. So one mouse is basically, it says, I'm just going to sit here and wait for the cheese to come back. Whereas the other mouse says, I don't think the cheese is coming back. I need to go and find new cheese.
Interesting. You
know? And it's a cute little book. And I actually had at the time on my staff read that book, because it really is about kind of the expectation and knowing that there's an abundance in the world. But if you stay home, again, like you just said, you know, or you just sit tight, it's not going to come to you. I mean, you have to swim out to the boat sometimes, you know. And I think what stops people many times is the fear of what's going to happen when they move forward. And you mentioned failure, and I think many people, fear and failure go together. They're afraid to fail, whereas how bad can it be? You know, as a child, it's like we fell down how many times? and our parents or would just pick yourself back up again, you know, and you did and you got over it and you continued running until you fell down again. So how do you deal with fear or embrace fear? Or how have you had fearful moments and what have you done to overcome those?
Sure. First of all, it's never as bad as you think it is. So fear can come from having difficult conversation with somebody. You know, I think I use this example of people who are in bad relationships, like boyfriend, girlfriend. Marriages are a little bit more complicated, so I don't want to talk about them. But you do have friends who have boyfriends and girlfriends, and they can't even break up with them. And I would almost look at breakups as a little bit of a test to handle difficult conversations when you're out in the business world. That how can you not do something that you need to do? You need to break up with this person. They're bad for you. Because if you can't do what you need to do, then you can't do what you want to do eventually.
Yes.
Which is being, you know, successful. So like those, and it's just a different frame of mind. In surgery, where if I'm doing a rhinoplasty and I'm just getting frustrated to straighten a nose and what I'm doing is not working, it's not working, it's not working. And in my mind, I've just turned around. Well, I've just found out three ways that don't work. So let me try a fourth and a fifth. And kind of what Thomas Edison had mentioned about, I didn't fail 10,000 times. I just found 9,999 ways that you can't make a light bulb, right? So Jim Rohn also talks about turning frustration into fascination. So we kind of joke around sometimes in the OR, I am fascinated right now, because those are the outer limits of your comfort zone and your zone of competence. And if you could break through that, you just become more competent. You become more confident. And those are signs that, I mean, that's how I look at it in a positive way. Like, it's supposed to hurt as you're growing. Muscles tear, they hurt as you lift weights. And the same goes with your mind. Like, it will get stretched a little bit. And again, you know, you want to avoid burnout. Like, you need, I can tell when I need to take a vacation for a little bit, and people should take vacations. So that's how I think about it. I just have a different spin on the way that I look at challenges. Yeah.
I think as well, as your business grows, many things come your way that you have to deal with that you never really thought about. And especially, you know, as a surgeon, you're a creator. You're a creator of a procedure or a creator of an experience. You know, but it does come with paperwork and administrative tasks that, you know, maybe other people, that is their skill set, that is their area where they really excel. But I do have one of our clients, and his attitude is, he looks at it as, I get to do this today. Like, he tries to be really positive about, oh, I get to do this today. So sometimes we'll joke here again. It's like, oh, we get to do accounting today. It's like, oh, it's not my favorite thing to do, but I get to do it today. So here we are. Let's enjoy this moment as much as we can and try and put a positive spin, knowing that if we do it now, then we'll be done with it. And tomorrow we can go back to creating.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think Tony Robbins also says the best. He says, you can always find what's wrong, but you can also always find what's right.
Yes.
And it's not being delusional or, you know, like that positive, like new agey thinking. It really is just looking at it from a better perspective, because it's the same situation, just from two different lenses that you're looking at it.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. So let me ask you now just about, like, you mentioned vacations and time out, you know, and burnout. So have you experienced burnout? Have you had staff experience burnout? Have you had colleagues experience burnout? And what have you learned from it?
I personally have not experienced burnout, but I can tell when I'm in need of a vacation, where, again, is it being a little bit more in tune with your body? Are you feeling more frustrated lately? You know, are you just more stressed than not? And maybe it's time for a little bit of a break. And I think a lot of doctors or entrepreneurs don't take vacations because, oh, how often do you hear, like, oh, when I'm out of the office, I lose like $100,000. And it's like, well, yeah, but you can't think of it like that. You need that time.
You can make $200,000. You know, that's how you have to look at it.
Say that one more time. I'm sorry.
Well, because when you come back from a vacation and being rested, you can make $200,000.
Yes.
You can have double the capacity that you had before you left.
Absolutely. And produce better results. And again, you're investing in yourself. Think of it as an investment in yourself. Because most great ideas come from the vacation, I think, and stepping away. And if you look at what a lot of people say is they encourage time away because that's really where you can take a break and look at something with a fresh lens. In
Yes.
fact, it's funny, I went to this little festival in Las Vegas and there was this sign in neon that read, "This is just the beginning," because it was like their first festival that they put on. And I took a picture next to it. And that has since resonated with me through my entire career, where it's become kind of like our internal motto. Like, this is just the beginning. This is just, when someone comes in for a rhinoplasty and they get their surgery, it's just the beginning of a new life.
Yes.
Every time we see a new consultation, it's just the beginning to make a good impression on someone.
That's
Even when
right.
patients come in for follow-up, it's always the beginning of continuing a better relationship or improving it. And in your skill set, it's always just the beginning. You can always get better. So, just that one place of showing up, going somewhere else, taking a break can really change the trajectory or give or shed light on where you should be going.
Yes, yeah. You know, it's interesting you mentioned festivals because I know a festival that we've had in common, and it's not something I do every year, but it's Burning Man. And
Yes.
Burning Man is something that, I've been to several times. I think you have too. And I was actually surprised when I first realized that plastic surgeons go to Burning Man and realized once, I actually, my first Burning Man was with a friend who is a plastic surgeon, and he got married at Burning Man. And that was a life changer for me in many ways. And as I've since been back, and I think with for you, I don't know what your experience with Burning Man is, but I know you've been several times. And but then when I realized, Nima goes to Burning Man, somebody else goes to Burning Man, all these different people go to Burning Man. So what is it about festivals and some aesthetic surgeons that becomes, is it the creativity? Is like what do you think it is about Burning Man that is so special to people like us?
There's a big art component. You really get to see really cool art pieces during the day and at night because like the day and the night are two different like worlds over there. I think the openness of everybody to be who you are without any kind of judgment, which I found very, very special. I think that's one of the things that we struggle with, and I see it here where someone comes in with like an ugly nose that they don't like. And they can't be themselves. And once they have a cuter nose, they can feel more authentic. And I think Burning Man allows people to be more authentic without feeling judged. Just the vibe of the place where people just generally care about each other without knowing each other, which I think is great. It's almost like it's a reinvigoration of humanity because you read so many bad things on the news, and you go to a place like this and people check in on you. Are you okay? Like, oh, nice to meet you. Hugs. I tell people you'll hug more people in a week than like
Yeah.
past 5 years of your life. And that human energy, I think, is just really recharging. And if you love music, I mean, whatever you love, you will find there, which is kind of like the magic of it. So I think it's a very, very special place that changed my life as well for the better.
You know, one of the things I think too is because, it appears to be, this big party, which it can be. It can be anything you want it to be, but it can also be a very harsh environment. And I think, one of the things I see in you is the resilience. And resilience was something I personally learned at Burning Man, and resourcefulness, as well as acceptance and many things. But I know it's like, you're in a very harsh climate, a very harsh environment. I've watched people's tents blow away, literally blow away. I've been caught in dust storms. I've had amazing experiences in the middle of a dust storm where we're hiding inside a piece of art with goggles and masks on because we're in a dusty wind tunnel for a good 10 minutes or longer, which seems like a lifetime when you're inside one of those. And I've met the most amazing people. As well as it really has made me very conscious of the planet in terms of, like, I'm really aware of when we just waste water. I'm really aware of when we have the guests on too long, or just resources. Because at Burning Man, you don't have any of those things. You have to provide everything for yourself. And so that to me was even in from a business perspective, is it's really made me think of making sure we always have backup. We always have enough of what we need in the business, even supplies, whether it's like paper, it's just things that all the things that you need to create success and balance so that you can do the things that are important to you. So that was kind of my Burning Man moment, as well as the art and the creativity and the people and everything else. It's amazing. So you say a new festival brought to you, which is sounds like a new motto for the practice. And what was that again?
This is just the beginning.
The beginning. I love that.
I think just to finish up with Burning Man, I think it just that radical self-reliance, it's an interesting concept where it's not a selfishness where I'm only going to take care of myself. It's if I take care of myself, then I can take care of you as well. And most people have it backwards, like, oh, I would die for you, I would do anything for you, but you really need to take care of yourself in order to. You got to put your own mask on first before you can put on your kid's mask on the plane. And that preparation that you need, I think, just attracts a better person. Like I've been to Coachella and it's nothing like Burning Man because you just need to prepare so much more to go to Burning Man that, and that's like life. It's like thinking ahead. It's like, okay, do I have enough water? Do I have enough food? Do I have enough runway in my business to last several months? Like, these little red flags that I see now, what will they be in the future? And really forces you to kind of think. And then finally, the resilience. And sometimes you just can't do anything about it, right? There's a dust storm and you just have to huddle down. Sometimes it's a winter of your practice and people aren't calling that week. And you just got to find something else to do until the time passes, which is maybe make videos or work on your website. And, but always constantly, just sometimes stuff happens and you need to deal with it. And it will pass. Everything passes, right?
Absolutely. I think that was a famous Winston Churchill quote, is this too shall pass.
Yeah.
And it did. World War II came to an end, and that was a life-changing moment in many, many ways for many, many people. Is there anything more that you would want to share with our audience about your journey to where you are currently in your practice in Beverly Hills? Any other things along the path that stand out that could be learning experiences for other people?
Sure. I think personally, and if you think about it and you read this, is if you're able to find your niche sooner than later. When I was with Simon Orion, he had told me a long time ago, he's like, just do noses. Like, you be the nose person. You need to specialize. And I didn't really take that advice until a little bit later on in my career. So what I found the result of that has been extremely fruitful is that now, because with social media, you have very distinct and audiences that are very specific. So you can be known for a nose person or just an eyelid person or just like lips person and or just breast augmentation, for example, and get famous for it. You can charge a premium for it. And the other cool thing is that you just can focus on getting good at this one procedure and people will want to come see you. There's more than enough people who want to get their noses done or their breasts done. And not being afraid to niche down, because how convincing are you, like, oh yeah, I can do your nose. By the way, I also do faces and brows and lip lifts and eyelid surgeries and mental, like a whole da 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 da. Like, well, how often do you do each? How can you be good at all of them? So one, picking your niche, what you love, and expanding that, I think is probably one of the best pieces of advice I can give to people starting their practice or in their practice currently. And you can be anywhere in the world and still make it. Like, I have a friend in Kentucky who's super busy. He's in Kentucky. All he does is noses. And they people fly in from all over.
It's interesting, and I think I don't want to say it's your personal style, because you want to think that you create a nose, a natural looking nose that is in balance and harmony with the face of the person. But I do think there must be certain things that you do that people, you don't say, oh, well, that's the Nima Shemarani. No, it doesn't, you're not known by the nose as much as the natural result that you create for each patient. Why rhinoplasty though? I mean, because I, from what I understand, rhinoplasty is actually one of the more difficult surgeries and very complex procedures
It's
compared
kind of,
to.
yeah. It's what came to me early, and then I just found it very interesting. It's kind of it's very artistic and sculpting and minute details. And then when I would do things like facelifts, I'd feel like a little bit more of a manual labor. Like just this is again my personal opinion, and no disrespect for people who do facelifts. It's just personally like I don't like all the suturing, and then you finish one side, you're like, oh God, I have to do another side. And I would just listen to my own like personal feedback versus the nose is I like it. It's in the center of the face, and you can do it. And so with that being said, I think the other thing transitioning is like once you pick that procedure or whatever you're doing, do the best possible job ever. Like, don't look at the time, don't look at the clock, don't compare yourself to other people who might be faster or whatever. You spend all this time getting this customer or patient on the operating room table, all that marketing, and then to not spend an extra hour or two to get like as perfect of a result as possible is just stupid because you've already done 98% of the work. Do that extra 2%, and then you start developing a reputation for being an amazing surgeon rather than a mediocre surgeon.
Yeah, I think as well is results, of course, is what you want, is you want the end result to be the very best result you can provide. And I think if you say you don't spend that extra time or you're rushing because you got a lunch date somewhere, or, you've got a, something else coming in, then you're not doing, you're not at your best. So how do you plan your schedule? I mean, do you obviously you need to allow adequate time to spend the extra time if it's necessary. Is there any tips for people with scheduling? Because we all have the same number of hours in the day, but some people seem to get more done than others.
Surgery is my biggest bottleneck, by far. It's I can't take meetings when I'm in surgery, et cetera. I only do one rhinoplasty a day, and we don't, I don't see that many patients afterwards. It's usually just like a couple follow-ups, and I try to prevent consultations on my surgical days. So I typically operate, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and now Fridays, and then Mondays are saved mostly for consultations. So you have to organize your schedule a little bit easier. Plus, it's better for your team because everybody's on the same page, and then they can plan their week a little bit better. And sometimes we have to push patients back or reschedule them if I'm taking a little bit longer in the operating room, because I think in the end, although it's a little inconvenient, they probably appreciate that their surgeon would take a little extra time to ensure they have a nice result.
Well, that's good that you can plan your surgery, so at least if there is any delay, it's not a surgical delay, so you're not, having surgical patients backing up, which, I mean, I have talked to surgeons who, they're doing a facelift at 8 o'clock at night because the day backs up so much, and it's just, how can you do your best when you've been going from 5 a.m. and now it's 8 and you're just starting your last facelift of the day? How do you do that?
I don't think you can. I mean, to be very frank, Angela, like if your brain is mush at that point, especially if you've been up since 5 in the morning, and to do an elective cosmetic procedure is just, I don't know. I think you need to find a better way of living than that.
I agree. I agree. So how do you find balance? I know you have a family, and as you said, when you started, you were single, so you kind of had all the hours in the day to focus on your business, and now you have a beautiful wife and family. So how do you create balance? Any tips there?
Sure. The more and more I talk to successful people, the more planning they have. So a week, weekly plan, there's something called non-negotiables, which is probably, your date night, one or two at least, your workouts, and whatever else is non-negotiable, whether it's like meditation, things like that. So, those, I think having a personal trainer, a set schedule makes it easier, right? Like if, for us, every date night, every Thursday is our date night, and we try to make it work every Thursday because of babysitting and whatnot. So once you get those non-negotiables, then you can start scheduling the things you need to do that are like important but not super urgent, and you just have to fill it in like that. But there's this book called The Perfect Week Formula, which is pretty good way of like planning out your week. And as you also know, I mean, you get to a certain point, you need to start planning your vacations a year in advance and getting this habit of like every October, let's start planning for the next year or whatever it is. Because if you don't plan for your vacations, then you're always scrambling, like, where should we go next? Oh my God, it's gonna be hard to get tickets and that
Yeah.
kind of
Or you
thing.
don't go. You say, oh, forget
Yeah, or you
it.
don't go. Yeah.
Yeah. No time this year.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, Neiman, this has been completely fascinating. I love it. And I really admire you. And I always admired you from when I first met you, and knowing and seeing like where you are today and what you created with your life is admirable.
Thank you
So,
so much.
yeah, thank you so much for being on the Aesthetic Insider Show. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. And I still remember the first day we met, Angela, was at, I think it was Environ Skincare, little presentation. So I still remember it's probably been about 11 or 12 years, I think. So happy to see your growth as well. And thank you very much for having me on as a guest.
Oh, absolutely, Nima. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the show today. And for those of you still with us, remember to watch next Wednesday as I bring another exciting guest to the Aesthetic Insider Show.